In March and April 1946, Torrey led a group of six men, me among them, to Great Britain and the continent to launch YFC there. For most of us, it was our first trip abroad. To cover all the territory, we split up into teams, and this led to diverse adventures. We were there less than a year after the end of World War II, and everywhere we encountered shortages, hardships, and rationing. Food especially preoccupied us, as it did most people there. During the first 3 weeks, we toured Great Britain from one end to the other, holding 3 and 4 meetings a day, almost everyone packed to capacity. We might be in a public hall on a Saturday night, in a fashionable church on a Sunday night, and in a movie house on a weekday night after the film. The people were still reeling from the war, starved for hope, and hungry for God. After a whirlwind tour of Holland, Denmark, Belgium, and France with Chuck Templeton during the next 3 weeks, we finally headed home. Right after we got back to the United States, we had a board meeting of Youth for Christ at a hotel in Swampscott, Massachusetts. A scant 2 weeks after that, I preached at the first of a half dozen rallies spread over the summer from Toronto to San Antonio and from New Jersey to Oregon, as well as at a couple of youth conferences. I was urged to hold further campaigns in Great Britain and ask Ruth to leave our year-old daughter Gigi with the extended family of grandparents, aunts, and uncles in Montreat and join me. I asked Strat Schufelt if he would come with me as song leader. But 2 or 3 weeks before we were to leave, he called to say he and his wife could not leave their 2 little girls. So I turned to Cliff Barrows. He and his wife, Billy, said they would be thrilled to go. So Cliff and Billy Barrows came to my rescue. During this summer of 1946, I recruited them to form a team with Cliff to lead the singing, Billy to play the piano, me to do the preaching. Ruth would do the praying while I preached. Right from the start, Cliff, in order to distinguish between me and his wife, called me Bill. We still had no idea how long we would be gone. After arriving in England early in October, we conducted rallies throughout England and Wales. With 40, perhaps 50 rallies behind us by mid-December, we were very tired and ready for a break. Somewhere, Ruth saw an ad featuring a palm tree waving in southern France. Since we were chilled to the bone, we immediately made reservations. We took off from London for the hour-and-a-half flight to Paris on December 16th, landing on an airstrip that was covered where there had been bomb craters with heavy net wire over the soft brown earth. With tremendous anticipation, we headed for Nice to spend Christmas. Our first glimpse of the beautiful Mediterranean was through the train windows en route from Marseille. On the other side of the tracks, though, along the coast, ruins of houses flattened by the war alternated with pillboxes. On Christmas afternoon, Ruth and I took a horse and buggy ride toward the Italian border. Everywhere along the way, we saw evidences of the war. Building after building was pockmarked with shell holes. It was a sobering reminder of the suffering so many had experienced so recently. And everywhere, because they had no money, girls were trying to sell themselves, which grieved us both greatly. We were deeply burdened and prayed daily for the people of Europe who had suffered so much and now had so little. Further meetings had been scheduled in Great Britain early in the new year. A couple of days after Christmas, we headed north with stopovers in Geneva and elsewhere in Switzerland. The creature comforts we had been reintroduced to on the continent were pretty much lacking in the English Midlands that winter. There was no central heat in the Wesley Hotel where we stayed. The common bath at the end of the drafty hall was also unheated. The small gas heater in our room ran only on the endless insertion of penny coins. Ruth huddled beside it in her robe, getting scorched on one side and frostbitten on the other. She moved away a little when Billy Barrows came in to say that Cliff had stuck his fountain pen too near their heater. It had caught fire and burned up before he could put the flame out. After 2 months, Ruth felt she had to return home to our little daughter Gigi, for whom she had longed every day. I still had 2 more months of meetings scheduled in Great Britain, so she would fly home alone on February 4. Our meetings had already started in Ireland. The day of her departure, we were staying in a tiny rooming house on the coast about 15 miles out of Dublin. I had the flu and had to kiss her goodbye without being able to take her to the airport. I was very lonely when she left and got a little homesick. I was very worried about our finances. We were down almost to our last dollar. I wrote a letter to industrialist R.G. Letourneau. He was the only wealthy man I knew in America who might give us consideration. I told him our predicament, adding that it would take $7,000 to finish the job. 2 weeks later, a letter came from him with a cashier's check for exactly that amount. Ruth was bothered also by something not completely unrelated to the illness I was battling when she left. She thought I was unwise to push myself so hard in the Lord's service. I returned home from our European tour at the beginning of April 1947, having been gone for 6 months. Those months had been a time of spiritual challenge and growth. My contact with British evangelical leaders during this and subsequent trips deepened my personal spiritual life. I was beginning to understand that Jesus Himself was our victory through the Holy Spirit's power. I developed an even deeper hunger for Bible study and new biblical insights for my messages. I quoted the Bible more frequently than ever before. At a YFC rally in Minneapolis, Minnesota, back in February 1945, only a month after I had joined Torrey Johnson's new venture, a man heard me preach who was now about to change my life radically. And that, incidentally, would lead me into great confusion about a great many things. If the amount of advance press coverage was any indication, the Los Angeles campaign was going to be a failure. As far as the media were concerned, the Los Angeles campaign, by far our most ambitious evangelistic effort to date, was going to be a non-event. Later, Lloyd got me a brief appointment with the mayor of Los Angeles, and the Los Angeles Times carried a small back-page picture and story about that meeting. Except for the ads that the committee ran in the church section, that was virtually the only press exposure we got for the first couple of weeks. The invitation to hold meetings in Los Angeles originally came from a group of businessmen who called themselves Christ for Greater Los Angeles, representing about 200 churches. They had already sponsored several such campaigns with other evangelists, all of which were reasonably successful. Now they wanted me to preach and to bring Cliff Barrows and George Beverly Shea. I agreed, but insisted on several stringent conditions. First, they were to try to broaden church support to include as many churches and denominations as possible. Second, they were to raise their budget from $7,000 to $25,000 in order to invest more in advertising and promotion. Third, they were to erect a much larger tent than they had planned. Our limited experience in citywide campaigns had already taught us that the crowd seemed to grow as the days went on. The men from Los Angeles initially agreed to every point except raising the budget. They were convinced it would be impossible to come up with such a large amount. They had a point. In those days, campaigns were modest efforts. Any evangelist preaching before more than 2,000 people was considered highly successful. To many of those seasoned older Christians, I came across as brash. But I found myself drafting a Los Angeles scenario bigger and bolder than anything I had imagined before. Besides insisting on the budget increase, I set yet another seemingly impossible condition. The committee had to put the public leadership and the platform duties of the campaign entirely in the hands of local clergy. The committee, I felt, represented too limited an evangelical constituency to make an impact. Even as I imposed these conditions on the long-suffering committee, I doubted that they would comply. Yet I burned with a sense of urgency to move forward. Initial reports from Los Angeles indicated that I was stirring up a hornet's nest. Some opponents circulated distorted and false stories about my being a self-promoting money-grabber. The kind of conditions I was insisting on certainly might have fueled that fire, and getting the committee's agreement would take a miracle. I was soon humbled when I found out what truly big men they were in the depth of their devotion to evangelism. They agreed to do what we had asked. The campaign was set to begin in the last week of September and run for 3 weeks. The attendance at our early Los Angeles meetings averaged about 3,000 each night and 4,000 on Sunday afternoons, so the tent was never filled to capacity. I sensed that interest was building, though, and the crowds were getting larger. However, I found that I was preaching mainly to Christians. As Ruth observed in a letter home to her folks in October, it is not easy to get unconverted to a tent. Nevertheless, I was preaching with a new confidence and fervor. I had always been loud and enthusiastic, and some have said authoritative. I was no longer struggling internally. There was no gap between what I said and what I knew deep in my soul. It was no coincidence that the centerpiece of the 150-foot platform in the tent, right in front of the pulpit, was a replica of an open Bible, 20 feet high and 20 feet wide. Stuart Hamlin invited me to be a guest on his radio show. I hesitated at first. Would the campaign committee want me on that kind of a program, sponsored by a tobacco company, even if Hamlin was the number one radio personality on the West Coast? The more I thought about it, the more intriguing the idea seemed. Hadn't Christ himself spent time with sinners? Hadn't he been criticized by the religious leaders of his day for that very thing? Why should not I take the risk? I said yes. On his show, he surprised me by telling all his listeners, in his own rough and ready manner, to go on down to Billy Graham's tent and hear the preaching. Even more surprising to his listeners, as well as to me, was his next remark, "I will be there too." The first night Stuart attended, we would find out later, he became deeply convicted of his own sins and the need for Christ to save him. Not understanding what was going on in his soul, he became angry and stalked out. For 2 or 3 nights, he stayed away. Then he came back. Each time he showed up, he had the same reaction, getting so mad once that he actually shook his fist at me as he walked out of the tent. We were approaching the scheduled closing night meeting, Sunday, October 16th, of our 3-week campaign. During the week before that final meeting, since there was evident blessing, some committee members advocated extending the campaign a short time. Others thought it should stop as planned. The choir, the counselors, and other workers were tired, and we might risk an anticlimax. The budget had been met, and now the organizers just took love offerings for Cliff and me. Everybody was confident the tent would be filled on the closing Sunday to give us a truly grand finale to an excellent series of meetings. Should the campaign be extended? It was not simply for the committee to decide. We needed a clear sense of direction from the Lord. Grady, Cliff, Bev, and I prayed together over and over again as the last week wore on. At last, we decided to follow the example of Gideon in the Old Testament and put out a fleece, asking God to give us a decisive sign of his purpose. It came at 4:30 the next morning. I was awakened in my room at the Langham Hotel by the jangling of the telephone. In a voice broken by tears, a man begged to see me right away. It was Stuart Hamlin. I woke up Grady and Wilma Wilson, and they went with Ruth into another room to pray. By the time I was up and dressed, Stuart and his praying, godly wife Susie were at my door. We talked together and prayed, and the rugged cowboy gave his life to Christ in a childlike act of faith. He came forward in the next service. It would not be long before Stuart put his vibrant experience into a song that was inspired by a conversation he had had with John Wayne. It is no secret what God can do. That still remains one of the favorites people like to hear Bev Shea sing. Years later, when we were back in Los Angeles for a crusade at the Coliseum, Cliff, Grady, Bev, and I went to Stuart's home for breakfast. "Billy," Stuart said at one point, "it is terrible that these planes come over the stadium while you are trying to preach. I am a member of the President's Club of Western Airlines, and I think I will call the President. If he will not do anything about it, I think I will get my old Longhorn rifle out and see if I cannot stop those planes from flying here. That very night, I was telling the crowd how Stewart was willing to get his Longhorn rifle out to bag a few of the low-flying airplanes when there was a terribly loud bang at the other end of the stadium. "Stewart, is that you?" I called out. The crowd roared. That night in 1949, Cliff and I knew that we had our answer about continuing the campaign. Clearly, the Lord had unfinished business to do in the lives of people who were just beginning to hear about the meetings and think about the gospel. We told the committee that the campaign had to go on, and they agreed. But for how long? During the next week, the first week of our extension, we were thrilled to hear Stuart Hamlin give his testimony over his radio program, telling listeners how Christ had changed his life. People were talking about it all along the West Coast. Did this justify another extension of the campaign? Cliff and I had not experienced such mounting interest and enthusiasm during our previous campaigns. In our uncertainty about what to do, we agreed the best thing was to put out the fleece again, as Gideon had done, and ask the Lord for another sign. We were relatively inexperienced young men with a lot to learn. Cliff was 4.5 years younger than I. Our wives were coping with our unpredictable lifestyles, but we wanted to be considerate of their feelings too. Would God give us another clear indication what to do? When I arrived at the tent for the next meeting, the scene startled me. For the first time, the place was crawling with reporters and photographers. They had taken almost no notice of the meetings until now, and very little had appeared in the papers. I asked one of the journalists what was happening. "You have just been kissed by William Randolph Hearst." I had no idea what the reporter was talking about. Hearst, of course, was the great newspaper owner. I had never met the man. The next morning's headline story about the campaign in the Los Angeles Examiner, followed by an evening story in the Los Angeles Herald Express, both owned by Hearst, stunned me. The story was picked up by the Hearst papers in New York, Chicago, Detroit, and San Francisco, and then by all their competitors. Until then, I doubt if any newspaper editor in America had heard of our Los Angeles campaign. Puzzled as I was, my curiosity was never satisfied. Hearst and I did not meet, talk by phone, or correspond as long as he lived. The newspaper coverage was just the beginning of a phenomenon. As more and more extraordinary conversion stories caught the public's attention, the meetings continued night after night, drawing overflow crowds. Something was happening that all the media coverage in the world could not explain, and neither could I. God may have used Mr. Hearst to promote the meetings, as Ruth said, but the credit belongs solely to God. All I knew was that before it was over, we were on a journey from which there would be no looking back. As the campaign went into its fifth week, we rearranged the seating to accommodate 3,000 more chairs. When that wasn't enough, crowds overflowed into the street. We added an extension, double the size of the 480-foot-long tent. The Associated Press put it on their priority A-wire service that went throughout the world. Both Life and Time magazines carried major stories. And the Los Angeles Times, the main competitor of the Hearst-owned papers, also picked it up in a big way, of course. People came to the meetings for all sorts of reasons, not just religious ones. No doubt some were simply curious to see what was going on. Others were skeptical and dropped by just to confirm their prejudices. Many were desperate over some crisis in their lives and hoped they might get a last chance to set things right. A few, we learned, were even sentenced to attend by a Los Angeles County judge, a woman who strongly supported the ministry and thought a night in the tent might do convicted offenders more good than a night in the jail. Occasionally, I invited others to preach for me. T.W. came 2 or 3 times from Minneapolis. One night, Bob Pierce, founder of World Vision and Samaritan's Purse, spoke for me. I introduced them, and then I would come back to the pulpit and give the invitation. We had meetings 6 nights a week and on Sunday afternoons. When newsreels of the campaign started appearing in theaters, people began to recognize us on the street. Of course, we had no staff to handle all the calls, letters, and telegrams that overwhelmed us in a daily avalanche. The word burnout was not in the popular vocabulary yet, but I was getting perilously close to that condition. Drained as I was, physically, mentally, and emotionally, I experienced God's unfailing grace in perpetual spiritual renewal. I wanted the campaign to close, but I was convinced God wanted it to continue. All my personal reserves were used up. I had to put my entire dependence on the Lord for the messages to preach and the strength to preach them. God's strength is made perfect in weakness, Paul wrote, and when I am weak, then am I strong. 2 Corinthians 12, 9 and 10 in the King James Version. It seemed that the weaker my body became, the more powerfully God used my simple words. Finally, a closing day came for the 1949 Los Angeles campaign, a month late. On Sunday afternoon, November 20, 2 hours before the start of the final meeting, 11,000 people packed the tent to standing room only. Thousands milled about in the streets, unable to get in. Hundreds left because they couldn't hear. On the platform with me were 450 fellow ministers, to whom now fell the awesome challenge of shepherding those who had come forward through the weeks. For that time, the statistics were overwhelming. In 8 weeks, hundreds of thousands had heard, and thousands had responded to accept Christ as Savior. 82% of them had never been church members. Thousands more, already Christians, had come forward to register various fresh commitments to the Lord. Some calculated that we had held 72 meetings. I had preached 65 full sermons and given hundreds of evangelistic talks to small groups, in addition to talks on the radio. That evening, exhausted after the final meeting, T.W., Ruth, and I got on the Santa Fe Super Chief train, hoping to get a couple of days of rest traveling back to Minneapolis. We were greeted by the conductor and the porter as though we were some kind of celebrities. A strange experience, believe me. As we knelt together to pray before climbing into our berths, we were both grateful and afraid. We could hardly find words to express to the Lord our thanks for His many mercies to us personally, and for His blessing on the Los Angeles campaign. But we feared that we did not have the capacity to live up to our responsibilities. People were expecting so much from us now. When the train stopped briefly in Kansas City, we were met by a couple of reporters. When we got to Minneapolis, the press was again there to interview us, along with some Twin Cities pastors and faculty and students from Northwestern schools. Until then, it had not fully registered with me how far-reaching the impact of the Los Angeles campaign had been. I would learn over the next few weeks that the phenomenon of that Los Angeles tent campaign at Washington and Hill Streets would forever change the face of my ministry and my life. Overnight, we had gone from being a little evangelistic team, whose speaker also served with Youth for Christ, to what appeared to many as the hope for national and international revival. Everywhere we turned, someone wanted us to come and do for them what had been done in Los Angeles. What they didn't know, however, was that we hadn't done it. I was still a country preacher with too much on my plate. Whatever this could be called, and whatever it would become, it was God's doing. In the middle of all the press hoopla in Minneapolis, one of George Wilson's little girls ran up and handed me a rose. "Uncle Billy," she said, "we prayed for you." And, of course, I had my own two little daughters praying for me every night. That put it all in perspective. That was the whole secret of everything that had happened. God had answered prayer. What we saw in 1950 were the early stirrings of a wide-reaching spiritual search, stirrings that helped to create an unaccustomed audience for the gospel. Disillusioned and disconnected people seemed willing to try anything. It was a morally promising but exceedingly perilous time. It was a trying time for me personally because I was not a profound analyst by nature,
nor could I claim a gift of prophecy. All I knew how to do was to preach the essential gospel as revealed in the New Testament and experienced by millions across the centuries. It was the old, old story of Jesus and His love, as a hymn writer put it. But maybe it caught fresh attention because it was such an unfamiliar story to so many. Statistics are never the full story of any crusade. But in the early stage in our ministry, the thousands and thousands of people verified for me a groundswell of public responsiveness to the gospel. With each new crusade experience, I was increasingly driven to the conclusion it was no fluke. Instead, it was the Lord letting us in on a special moving of the Holy Spirit in America. With that conviction, I was open to three unforeseen developments. The first such development had to do with films and evangelism. While still a student at Wheaton College, I thought that someone ought to make evangelistic motion pictures. The one and only religious film that I had seen was amateurish and unlikely to appeal to unchurched people. Our first effort in that direction came in connection with the Portland Crusade in 1950. Bob Pierce had told me about a filmmaker named Dick Ross who had accompanied him on a trip to China and prepared a documentary that was well received in churches. "You ought to have one of your crusades filmed," Bob urged me. After some discussion, the local committee in Portland invited Dick to send a small crew to make a 16-millimeter color film about the crusade, which could be shown in churches in the Northwest. Dick had a small production company called Great Commission Films. Eventually, his company merged with the company we ourselves had already set up, Billy Graham Films. We later changed the name to Worldwide Pictures. I felt that my name might discourage some people from attending. We constructed a building in Burbank, just across from the Walt Disney Studios. The Portland story was the first of about 200 films we have done. Soon after the Portland Crusade, Dick and I got to talking about the use of films in evangelism. "Why," I asked, "don't we do a fictional story that would be a dramatic picture, totally Christian and evangelical and evangelistic, appealing to young people?" Our next crusade was scheduled to be in Fort Worth in early 1951, and we decided to make the film there. We centered the film story around the conversion of a rodeo rider in that crusade. Red Harper and Cindy Walker agreed to star in Mr. Texas, which cost us $80,000 to make. In a fit of brashness, we rented the Hollywood Bowl for the world premiere. The outdoor arena seated 25,000 people. 5,000 more sat on the hillside. The audience included some of Hollywood's best-known film executives, among them Cecil B. DeMille, Frank Freeman, and Walter Wanger. The second development had much more immediate consequences for us. Some months before, in Boston, I heard over the radio that Dr. Walter A. Meyer, the great Lutheran theologian and radio preacher from St. Louis, had died of a heart attack. I was so jolted that I knelt in my hotel room and prayed that God might raise up someone to take his place on the radio. In those days, radio was still king. Television's impact was just beginning to be felt. There were only a few evangelical programs on national radio, and none seemed to have a wide audience among non-believers. Dr. Meyer and Charles Fuller were virtually the only preachers on national radio at the time. Earlier that summer, while preaching at a Bible conference led by Walter Smith in New Jersey, Cliff and I stopped for lunch one day at a roadside diner and were greeted by a big, smiling man whose eyes grew large as he studied me. "Hallelujah!" he shouted, grabbing and pumping my hand. "What an answer to prayer! I was just sitting here praying that I might meet Billy Graham, and in you walk. I did not even know you were on the East Coast." He introduced himself as Dr. Theodore Elsner, a preacher from Philadelphia. "I have a great burden on my heart," he said. "It is a message that I believe is from the Lord. Billy, you must go on national radio. You know that Dr. Meyer is dead, and you are the man God could use to touch America through radio." I did not know what to think. Dr. Elsner urged me to contact Fred Dinert, his son-in-law, and Walter Bennett, a Christian who was also a radio agent. Impressed though I was by this abrupt meeting, I did not look up either Dinert or Mr. Bennett. Indeed, I pretty much forgot the whole idea. I was so busy that I could not imagine adding anything else to my plate. A few weeks later, I was speaking at a conference in Michigan. Two well-dressed strangers approached and introduced themselves as Fred Dinert and Walter Bennett. I did not know whether Dr. Elsner had spoken with them since he had met me, but their mission was to interest me in a national radio program. I told Fred and Walter that I appreciated their interest, but that I simply could not do a radio program at the time. My closest advisors, Cliff, Bev, and Grady, concurred it was out of the question. Now, in Portland, these two extremely persistent men repeatedly lay in ambush to catch me. All they wanted, they claimed, was 5 minutes of my time. I got so irritated with their pestering that sometimes I took a back elevator to avoid them. I finally told Grady to let them know I was not interested in their scheme to get me into broadcasting. "Leave me alone," was my message. But as I came out of the hotel one night, there they were. "We want to say goodbye," one of them said. "We're leaving tonight for Chicago." "All right, fellas," I said laughingly. "If before midnight tonight I should get $25,000 for the purpose of a radio broadcast, I'll take that as an answer to prayer and be willing to do a national broadcast." The thought was so incredible to them that they laughed along with me before heading for the airport. More than 17,000 people were at the meeting that night. Just before introducing my friend Bob Pierce for a brief report on his travels in the Far East, I told them about the burden Walter and Fred had for broadcasting the gospel and the $25,000 condition I had laid down. The audience joined in my laugh. After Bob spoke, I preached and then extended the invitation to receive Christ. Afterward, in the little room set aside for me in the tabernacle, a number of people dropped by to greet me. Several of them said they believed God had spoken to them during the service about helping us go on national radio. They began to leave cash, checks, and pledges. I couldn't believe it. "Billy," said Frank Phillips when everybody had left, "people have given us $24,000 tonight for radio." Their confidence and generosity were enough to make me weep. But how could this be God's answer? It was $1,000 short. I told Grady, Cliff, Ruth, and Frank that maybe the devil could give us that much to mislead us. We agreed to say nothing to anyone else about the funds and went out to eat. It was our custom to have supper after the service. That night we went to a little Japanese sukiyaki place across the street. Ruth continued to cultivate my taste for Oriental food. We got back to the hotel about 11:30. "There are two letters here for you, Mr. Graham," said the desk clerk. Postmarked 2 days earlier, they were from people I hardly knew, businessmen Howard Butt and Bill Meade. Both said they believed we should go on the radio and that they wanted to be the first to contribute. And each enclosed a $500 check. Stunned, I bowed my head and said a silent prayer. Emotion so overcame me that I could not think straight. Clearly, the funds had come from God. Then, when I turned to go to the elevator, who should be standing in the lobby but Walter and Fred? They had been at the airport, they said, but something had told them not to get on the plane. I put my hands on a shoulder of each man. "Sign us up for radio for at least 13 weeks, I told them. "God has answered prayer. We have the $25,000. We'll take this as a step of faith." I was not kidding about that, since the total estimated cost at $7,000 per week would be $91,000, an astronomical amount that was nowhere in sight, not in my sight, anyway. Walter and Fred arrived in New York on a Saturday to conclude the contract, and they found only one person in the ABC company offices, a junior executive. He informed them that the ABC board had just made a decision not to allow any more religious programming on the network. Walter and Fred protested. "You promised it. We have guaranteed this young man, Billy Graham, that he has a network. To change your minds now is very unfair to us. Get a hold of the board. That is impossible, he said. They are all playing golf. Well, get them on the golf course. I can't do that, he said, digging in his heels. You will have to wait till Monday. We are not coming back on Monday, they said firmly. We will sit here until this thing is resolved. Seeing their determination, the man finally reached one of the board members on the 18th hole and explained the situation. The board's decision was reversed on the spot, and the hour of decision was saved. In mid-August, we signed a contract for 13 weeks with the American Broadcasting Company to go on their coast-to-coast network, with a target starting date during our upcoming Atlanta Crusade. When we were considering going on radio, some people suggested that we adopt a folksy or informal format. But I analyzed the styles of those who had the highest ratings of the time, newsmen such as Walter Winchell, Drew Pearson, and Gabriel Heater, as well as the late Dr. Meyer, whom I admired greatly. All four were fast and intense speakers. That fitted my own natural style. From the first, I decided to use a lot of current illustrations from national and international affairs, as well as from social issues. I wanted to bring the Bible to bear on those matters, concentrating on a direct presentation of the gospel with a clear call to decision. For a while, I even had a news teletype machine in our house so I could keep abreast of the latest events for these messages. Listener response immediately confirmed that we were meeting a need in people's lives. Within 2 years, we were receiving 3,000 to 4,000 letters a week. This correspondence was the beginning of our mailing list. The programs quickly became self-sustaining with a minimum of comment about finances. In 1954, we extended the hour of decision to the NBC network as well, bringing the total to 800 stations. That did not include foreign and shortwave. One final development during the Portland Crusade came about as a direct result of the money we collected to start our radio evangelism. Grady Wilson and I had a problem. Underneath his bed in the hotel in Portland, Oregon, was a shoebox filled with $25,000 in cash, checks, and pledges. But what could we do with the money? Offerings for all our campaigns and crusades had always been collected by the local sponsoring committee and placed in a bank account set up by that group. But the money in the shoebox had been collected for a purpose that had nothing to do with the 1950 Portland Crusade, and therefore couldn't be deposited into the local crusade account. As I told the crowd that evening, the collection would go toward radio. Needless to say, the money needed to be deposited in a bank right away. Either one of us could open a local account under his own name and deposit the money in it, of course, but he would be subject to income tax on the full amount. The larger problem we had begun to realize was that we had no formal organization. We had quite simply been known as the Graham Barrows Campaigns, but we had never formed a separate corporation or opened a bank account in that name. For that matter, we did not even have a board of directors. To make things worse, if we did go on the air nationwide, people would probably send us contributions to purchase more radio time. But then we would be dealing with a larger number of donors, and quite possibly with larger amounts of money. From time to time, we talked about establishing a separate nonprofit organization for our work. George Wilson, our business manager at Northwestern Schools, had even made some preliminary inquiries with an attorney. I called George from Portland and told him our desperate, if happy, problem. He suggested that we go ahead with formal incorporation, and almost immediately he filed documents in St. Paul, the capital of Minnesota, establishing the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, often abbreviated BGEA. George was the one who chose the name, although I protested strongly. George protested just as strongly that the new organization needed to be identified with my name, since I was the major evangelist. 47 years later, I still wish my name were not so visible. It is God's organization, not mine. And if we ever lose sight of that fact, God will withdraw His blessing from our work. It was now a year since we had completed the Los Angeles Crusade, which had thrust us into the national media spotlight. So much had happened so fast. Clearly, it had been the year of the whirlwind. Cumulative attendance at the meetings passed the 1.5 million mark, with nearly 50,000 recorded inquirers. It was the Lord's doing, and it was marvelous in our eyes. But if things went on at this rate, where might they lead? I needed time to catch my breath and my balance, both. Invitations flooded in, and with 8 crusades scheduled, ranging from 3 days to 6 weeks, we were booked every month in 1951. As our calendar began to fill up even further, 1952 was starting to shape up much the same. Our main concern, of course, whether at a crusade or on the radio or at some other speaking engagement, continued to be the souls of people. Clearly, the Lord was setting our course for the immediate future. In the 1 year between Los Angeles and Atlanta, we had developed an organization, a radio broadcast, a film ministry, a financial policy, and a compatible team. Now we needed to find out if all these things would work. Over the years, I've met so many of the rich and famous in many countries that it's impossible to mention or even remember them all. But presidents and royalty aren't typical of the people I've had contact with. It was 1952, and I was on the most far-fetched mission I could imagine. Sometime before, I'd had dinner with a friend from Fort Worth, Texas, oil baron Sid Richardson, whom I affectionately called Mr. Sid, and we had discussed General Dwight D. Eisenhower as a possible candidate in the 1952 election. Mr. Sid had urged me to contact Eisenhower and encourage him to run. During Eisenhower's short tenure as president of Columbia University, his speeches had marked him as a conservative, but nobody knew his party affiliation. Rumor said Harry Truman hoped he would run as a Democrat. In spite of Mr. Sid's confidence in me, I had no illusions about being able to persuade Eisenhower to run. Afterward, he had been telling both parties for years that he was not interested, and I was not interested in being sidetracked by politics. Though a registered Democrat, a sort of birthright in the part of the South where I came from, I always voted for the man and not the party. I wrote the same thing in a letter to Mr. Sid, which he forwarded to Eisenhower in France, where he was serving as commander at the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Powers in Europe, SHAPE. In it, I stressed the need for a man like the general to become president. The American people have come to the point where they want a man with honesty, integrity, and spiritual power, I wrote to Mr. Sid. I believe the general has it. I hope you can persuade him to put his hat in the ring. On November 8, 1951, Eisenhower wrote to me, cordially reacting to the case I had presented in my letter which Mr. Sid had shared with him, and reaffirming his refusal to make a partisan declaration. A month later, I wrote directly to him for the first time. Nobody could accuse me of understatement. I even brashly told him that I had been in Europe 6 times since the end of World War II, and I know something of your dilemma. Back then, I wasn't adverse to publicly criticizing the U.S. State Department for its many blunders, but how foolish and presumptuous that appears now. I was told that Eisenhower said to Mr. Sid, "That was the damnedest letter I ever got. Who is this young fellow?" "I will send him over so you can meet him," Mr. Sid replied. Meanwhile, Eisenhower's letter to me sharpened my desire to see him become president under whatever label he chose. Shortly after the Washington Crusade in early 1952, I traveled by ship to Europe, going by way of England, where Ruth and I, Cliff and Billy, and T.W. stopped at the invitation of the British Evangelical Alliance to hold discussions with British clergy about a possible crusade there and in Germany. Then on to Paris. By this time, it was March. At SHAPE, General Eisenhower welcomed me warmly with outstretched hand and a wide smile. He was younger looking than I had expected and more down to earth. the general shared some of his religious experiences as a boy. His parents had been River Brethren, a small but devoutly pious group in the Mennonite tradition. They had read the New Testament in the original Greek and had taught their sons to memorize Scripture, just as my parents had taught me. He asked me about the Washington Crusade in the National Guard Armory and the message I was preaching. I considered that an especially perceptive question. Most people assumed they knew what preachers were all about, but the general was interested enough to probe my basic message. He listened intently and confessed that he and his wife, Mamie, rarely attended military chapel services, even during wartime. We talked about the Korean War and about the gains communists were making around the world. And, of course, we talked about the following November's election. "General Eisenhower," I said, "I must tell you that no matter how much I might be for you privately, I couldn't issue a public political statement." "I'm glad to hear you say that," he said. "I would not expect you to." In more than 2 hours together, at no time did he hint that he would run. Still, I left feeling that I had met the next president of the United States. 4 months later, in Chicago, the Republican convention nominated General Eisenhower with Senator Richard Nixon as his running mate. To my surprise, a call came from Frank Carlson, a senator from Kansas whom I had gotten to know during our Washington crusade. He told me that General Eisenhower wanted to see me. Mystified, I traveled immediately to Chicago to meet him at the Blackstone Hotel. Apparently, Carlson had sold Eisenhower on the idea that I could contribute a religious note to some of his campaign speeches. "Would you be willing?" Eisenhower asked. "Of course, I want to do anything I can for you," I said. "But as I told you last spring, I have to be careful not to publicly disclose my preferences or become embroiled in partisan politics." "I understand," he said, "but would you be able to come and see me in Denver next month? Plan on spending a few days." In August, we were together at the Brown Palace Hotel in Denver for several sessions. During these, I gave him some scripture verses I thought he might find helpful. Once I absent-mindedly addressed him as Congressman. I quickly recovered, but said, "Senator." By the time I got around to General, he was laughing, and I was red-faced. "Why do you not just call me Ike?" he said. But I never could. It was Mr. President when he was in office, and General when he was not. I respected his desire to inject a spiritual tone into his campaign, and the moment inevitably came when I felt free to talk to him about his own faith. "General, do you still respect the religious teaching of your father and mother?" "Yes," he said, adding softly, "but I have gotten a long way from it." I also felt free to present the gospel to him and to clarify again the message that I preached. He told me that he had become disillusioned with the church early on when some preachers seemed to detour from spiritual essentials to merely social or even secular matters. "Frankly," I said, "I don't think the American people would be happy with a president who didn't belong to any church or even attend one." "As soon as the election is over, I will join a church," he said, "but I'm not going to do it in order to get elected. I do not want to use the church politically." "What denomination do you have in mind?" I asked. "I've thought about that," he said. "I suppose Presbyterian, because Mamie is Presbyterian. Do you know any good Presbyterian churches in Washington?" I recommended a couple, including National Presbyterian, where the pastor had been a wartime chaplain on the European front. In the course of our meetings in Denver, I gave him a red leather Bible, which I inscribed to him on the flyleaf. In later years, some articles mentioned that he kept a red Bible by his bedside during his presidency. Shortly after the election, an opportunity for ministry arose that effectively removed me from any further direct involvement with General Eisenhower before his inauguration. For months I had been receiving letters from missionaries, chaplains, GIs, and Korean religious leaders asking if I could come to Korea. The war was in full swing, but much as I wanted to comply, going seemed impossible. Back then, our schedule was made up almost 2 years in advance, and I hesitated to cancel anything already established. The year 1952 had already proved the most strenuous in my ministry. We had held more crusades, scheduled more meetings, and I had preached more sermons than ever. We were involved in radio, television, and film, and we were even writing a book. How could I possibly squeeze in a Korean tour? Before the upcoming Albuquerque meetings, Ruth was able to join me in Florida, and we had a couple of days to ourselves. As Ruth and I settled into a little hotel room for a couple of days, I suddenly turned to her. "Darling, what would you think about my going to Korea to spend Christmas with our troops?" Since Ruth had been born in China and had attended high school in Korea, she knew and loved the land and its people. "I think it would be wonderful," she said without hesitation. "It's hard to think about a Christmas away from home," I said. "We will manage," she assured me. Our first stop was Japan, and I will never forget seeing that beautiful coastline from the air. We were several hours late, but as we got off the plane, we were greeted by well-wishers singing Christian songs in English and carrying a sign that read, "Welcome, Billy Graham, to Japan." I preached in several meetings before leaving Japan. I felt great liberty in speaking, and this confirmed in my heart that God had indeed sent us. Then we left for Korea.